Hello, Bill Scher.
Good morning, Matt Lewis. Or should I say Matt K. Right. Lewis?
Matt K. Lewis. Yeah, there are too many Matt Lewises out there. And so this, you know, the Matt K., as I fight to own the Matt Lewis brand, which is tough when there are, you know, famous Matt Lewises around the world, I also staked out Matt K. Lewis, which is my Twitter handle. So at the very least, I can own that brand, hopefully.
Are you comfortable with me asking, what does the K stand for? All these years, I do not know what the K is for.
It's Kenneth. It's sort of boring, named after my grandfather. And so I have, this is why my children have very interesting and weird names, because, you know, nobody wants to do, like, I'm an only child, and so I didn't want to have, I didn't want my kid to be an only child, so I now have two, and I have a name, which is a good name, Matt Lewis. You can't really, you can't complain about it, but it's also, you know, there was a lot of Matt Lewises. I think there were three Matt Lewises at Shepherd College when I went there in West Virginia, which could lead to some confusion, or it could get you out of trouble if you could blame the other Matt Lewis. So I named my kids, you know, more sort of interesting names to avoid that. So, but K, the K, Matt K. Lewis is K is for Kenneth. But if, you know, Kennedy would have been maybe cooler. Or something. You could have done cooler, but Kenneth is the name.
I feel that there's a regalness to Kenneth. You know, it's not just Ken or Kenny. It feels classy.
Yes. I don't know that there are a lot of people being born today named Kenneth. I feel like it's
not after 30 Rock. Maybe a few years need to pass after.
Yeah, you're right. I guess that might have killed. You never know. Like, what if your name was, like, Bart Simpson or something? I mean, you know, it doesn't even have to be an actor or a real person who screws you in the name game. It could be, you know, tomorrow there could be, like, the biggest, you know, like, you know, I don't know, jerk in the world could be like a cartoon character by the name of Matt Lewis. And, you know, it's like being Eric Cartman or something. What do you do?
In the mid 90s, when I was living in DC, my landlord's name was Amy Fisher, which if you were of a certain age, you know, that.
Oh, yeah.
You actually remember Amy Fisher was the, you know, the teenager who shot Jerry Buttafuoco.
Right.
And so
right.
I would get phone calls in the office. Yeah, people would, you should call me office like, Bill, Amy Fisher's on the phone for you?
Well, you know what, Bill? I remember I lived in a house, a group house in Springfield, and they still had left over like the sign from when it was rented, and it said something like, call Amy Fisher. And we joked about it. I wonder if this is the same Amy Fisher.
I don't know.
Were you in Springfield?
I was in the district.
Okay, because I don't want to overextend the Simpsons metaphor, but I was living in Franconia, Springfield, a suburb of the nation's capital, and maybe it was the same Amy Fisher.
Maybe.
We laughed about it. We were laughing about it back then. No, I'm sure nobody born after 1985 would have any idea what we're talking about.
Well, back to our normal DMZ issues at hand.
I noticed... just talk about names. I mean...
I noticed on your Twitter feed, you were being, I don't want to put words in your mouth, I feel you were defending Karl Rove in his comments about Hillary's concussion, where he was suggesting perhaps she might have brain damage. Right. you thought that people were taking his quote out of context and being unfair to him. Is that a fair characterization of your view?
Well, first let me say, there's a tie-in here to Ben Sasse and what I want to talk about in a few minutes, which is that a lot of what I sort of know comes from off-the-record things, and it just informs your reporting, but I can't really talk about it. So, like, along those lines, I've been to Karl Rove's speeches that were off-the-record, and he says really interesting things that he would never say in public. It's sort of like, I don't know if you remember, I think it was Frank Luntz a couple years ago, got in trouble maybe like a year or so ago at a college where he was thought he was off the record and he attacked Rush Limbaugh and some student actually recorded it and it burned him. Well, Rove sort of does this stuff too. He says things that are like titillating and in off the record settings. I know because I've been there and the audience eats it up and it's interesting. And I think this was also an off the record speech, I believe, that he gave. where he said this about Hillary. So first, that's an important thing to keep in mind, is that, you know, I think that there's a little showmanship here to it, right? And a little sort of, he says things sort of jokingly, tongue-in-cheek. And I suspect that's part of what was at play here. The other thing, though, is, I mean, look, what is it, you know, is it not okay to question the health of the person who could be the commander-in-chief and the most powerful person in the free world? I mean, we've already basically said you can't attack Hillary on her age. Now it's also health isn't a legitimate issue. I mean, look, she did have this incident. She hasn't been incredibly forthcoming about it. And so maybe it's unseemly for Rove to speculate about it, even in an off-the-record situation. Maybe it's not chivalrous or polite. But, I mean, come on. This is a very serious position, and I think it's a fair game to question somebody's health.
Well, I generally agree with that. I think, you know, I think all sides raise health matters when they have an opening to do so. That's not an unusual matter in politics. And there's definitely a big push from the media to get health questions answered. I mean, one of the most famous recent cases that Paul Tsongas ran for president in 1992, being a cancer survivor, and I know people wanted to see his medical records, and he would answer questions like, "Look, you know, I'm a cancer survivor. I'm a clean bill of health now, and you know, I'm ready for the job." People wanted more information about that. Now he didn't get far enough in the contest for other reasons, and he ended up dying, you know, not too long after that from a relapse, and so it did raise some questions whether he was being forthright or not. But I think at one point he even said, you know, so he was asked, you know, what if you had cancer again? And he said, well, then you have a president who has cancer. You know, I mean, presidents have health problems. You get a vice president. We have a system for that. So, you know, the Constitution, you know, rolls on. But those are fair questions. I think what is trickiest for Rove, I mean, the specific quote is, I mean, there's two problems with Rove's comment. One, he said she was in the hospital for 30 days, which was factually wrong. And then she says, when she reappears, she's wearing glasses that are only for people who have traumatic brain injury. We need to know what's up with that. That seemed to be more leading and mischievously speculative as opposed to sober investigation.
Yeah. I think that there was some shtick and hyperbole clearly there. I would also say, though, when I woke up yesterday morning, I use myself as a test case because I try to be, you know, I try to call him like I see him, Bill. So when I woke up and I looked at my iPhone and I started seeing the headlines and the tweets about what Rove said, I have to be honest with you, my first instinct was to blame Rove. Like, what? What another, you know, such a stupid thing. Why did he, you know, that was my gut instinct was to think that Rove had messed up. Then I actually clicked on the story. It might have been Politico. I don't remember. But whoever it was, I read the story and I started reading like what Rove actually said. And I was like, in other words, I felt like this story was overblown and overplayed and overhyped, that what Rove actually said wasn't as egregious as the way the sort of breathless reporting and pearl clutching that was taking place. I also want to say this, Bill. We talked about this the other week because I recently wrote something. I was reading Michael Lewis's book, Losers.
So you or me?
That ain't me.
Man, that beeps in my house. Let me see. Let me see if my house is burning down. Why don't you keep rolling, okay?
Okay. So for those who may not be able to hear it, there's a very loud screeching sound. It may be a fire alarm. Bill may or may not be in peril. So I was reading the Michael Lewis book, Losers. And in the book, there's a line about how... you know, Michael Lewis was on the campaign trail in 1996, and he was trailing, like, people like Pat Buchanan and Steve Forbes and, you know, all sorts of people like that, Phil Graham. And he said that, like, all of them had a theory about how Bob Dole was actually really sick and how he would have, Bob Dole would have to drop out of the race and that they would end up winning because of that. And so Bob Dole, of course, is still alive. And we're many, many years now removed, you know, 18 years or something removed from this campaign. And so it's sort of macabre, but I guess there's a sort of macabre wishful thinking, to fantasize that your adversary, that the person between you and standing between you and the White House will have health issues. So even though I think it's entirely legitimate to bring this issue up and to raise it and to ask questions about it, and voters have the right to know. And we do know that politicians have concealed this, and it's not just Tsongas, it's Jack Kennedy and FDR and others. I mean, and you know, so it's a fair point, but I would also advise Republicans, like, don't, you know, it's, I hate to put it this way, but don't get your hopes up that there's, that Hillary's not going to run, because she very well may, it may be, and she's in all likelihood as healthy as a clam.
Yeah,
it, that's it an just, expression.
It just seems like, in all likelihood, pretty weak sauce. You know, she's, it, I mean, it's like when you go after, you know, there were, you know, subtle jabs made at McCain about his age. But the Obama campaign was pretty careful not to be like, old people shouldn't be president, but to wrap it in kind of a out of touch meme, to say they just didn't understand the problems of today. And that kind of line is pretty risky, and could easily not hit the mark, but then McCain would act kind of old and doddering in the debates. And look, I think McCain has perfectly fine faculties. I mean,
I think McCain's going to run for re-election, and I think he's going to serve another 6 years. I mean,
right. But he behaved in a way that, not doddering old man. I think that's right. But he acted in kind of an out of touch manner, in the debates, that it had been like a get off my lawn vibe to it.
Reagan in the first debate against Mondale, Reagan was overprepped apparently and did not perform well, and that opened the door to the age issue, which of course he diffused.
Well, yeah, I've actually written about this before. You people should watch that first Reagan Mondale debate in with distance, because in watching it, he didn't seem old and doddering. He didn't seem
right, what I'm repeating is, because, as you may imagine, Bill, these things become conventional wisdom.
What I'm repeating is
basically, I don't know that I've ever watched in its entirety the first Reagan-Mondale debate. But these things become essentially conventional wisdom, and the shorthand is that in the first debate, Reagan stumbled, that he was overprepared, he didn't perform well, and that opened the door to people questioning the age issue, which, of course, he hits out of the ballpark in the second debate. What I'm reciting is the shorthand of what happened. It sounds like you've actually gone back and watched the tape.
I mean, it was interesting about that first debate is, I mean, Reagan's not his best, but he's actually loaded with facts and figures. I mean, one thing that's interesting about that debate is just the level of expectation in these debates as far as what information you would have at your disposal is so much different than the expectations today, where everything is very constricted in 90-second sound bites, and so no one's expecting deep dives into policy. Reagan was talking about a whole lot of policy. He just wasn't, you know, it just wasn't his A game, but it wasn't like signs of dementia.
But the spin on it or the take on it is that Reagan was overprepped, that he had too many facts, much that he was trying to show that he had command of facts and numbers and statistics, and so then the line "Let Reagan be Reagan" emerges. By the way, while we're talking Reagan, Let me give a couple just quick plugs. One, I just interviewed Ken Edelman, who was with Reagan at Reykjavik. I learned he was also Muhammad Ali's interpreter in Zaire against in that fight against George Foreman. He has a book out called Reagan at Reykjavik. You can check out my podcast. So for Matt Lewis' show, I interviewed him. I also interviewed a guy named Serhii Plokhii, who wrote a book called The Last Empire, The Final Days of the Soviet Union. And this dude is actually a professor. He's a professor of Ukrainian history at Harvard. And really good book about the... it's very. I think I bring these things up because we're talking about Reagan, but they're also sort of timely now with the whole Ukraine-Putin thing happening. I've interviewed both of them on my podcast, so check that out.
You get fantastic guests on your podcast. People should definitely check out your podcast on a regular basis because you get some pretty fascinating people to come on. Just to tie back to the Reagan thing, I think is actually relevant about this to today is, I mean, you know, Mondale was getting crushed going into that first debate. The fact that Reagan, you know, didn't have his best day, I mean, it's just like with Obama and Romney and a lot of other incumbents that go into televised debates for re-election, expectations are often out of whack, and it hurts the incumbent briefly. You know, the media jumped on this whole, is Reagan too old thing, Democrats got all excited about it, is this going to make the whole thing turn? And all it did was just set Reagan up to you know, show his best stuff and show his quick wit and sharpness in the second debate and diffuse all those concerns. You know, this Rove attack on Hillary only works if Hillary starts, you know, wobbling around the stage and, you know, suddenly collapsing in the middle of a speech or suddenly starts, you know, spouting nonsense. You know, if she comes across being perfectly sharp and capable, any kind of health question or age question totally disintegrates. So it just puts the ball in her court. And without any real hard evidence that she actually has a brain injury, that it's not a particularly wise bar to set.
Well, again, I don't. There's some speculation that Rove was sort of intentionally floating this idea, you know, the way that like Harry Reid does about Mitt Romney's taxes. I don't think that. Having been to some of these off the record things, I think this is Rove's shtick. I think he's playing to the audience, and you know, I don't think he intended this to become a narrative to subtly float a trial balloon. But I agree with you that when Bob Dole falls off the stage, that reinforces a bad narrative. The way that Hillary Clinton can overcome this and the age issue, the health issue and the age issue, is to run a robust campaign. And she can't do what she did last time, which is the whole coronation thing. What she needs to do is to be very aggressive, sort of like she was when she ran for Senate in New York, and get out there among the people, show energy, show enthusiasm, fight, ask for votes, fight for it, and that will dispel these narratives, right? But what if she doesn't? If she falls off the stage like Bob Dole, which, you know, and again, even that, that was probably overblown, right? It's sort of like the whole George H.W. Bush not knowing about a scanner at a grocery store, like not really the true story. Like Bob Dole did, I think, fall off, but he got right back up, and, you know, for a 70-some-year-old guy to, you know, is probably fairly athletic. And people think that Gerald Ford, who was like a football star in college, was bumbling because he, like, fell down once coming off an airplane, and then Chevy Chase started mocking him. I mean, that's how narratives set in. Right. So I think that Hillary can overcome it, but if there is a misstep that reinforces this narrative, then she's in deep trouble.
Well, in elections current, last week there was always talk that the establishment was triumphing over the Tea Party in the North Carolina primaries. Now the Tea Party favorite wins in Nebraska. Ben Sasse, am I pronouncing the last name correctly?
Yes, you are.
Do you think this is, you know, one for the establishment, one for the Tea Party, or there's the other narrative, of course, which this isn't even that much of a civil war in the first place. There's a lot of convergence between establishment and Tea Party right now. and this is more just about sort of the local peculiarities of that race.
So I think this is very interesting. We do live in fascinating times, and I think in North Carolina you had a guy, Tom Tillis, who was, you know, the establishment guy, but he's a conservative, and I think that, you know, the grassroots, you know, Tea Party base can live with Tom Tillis, and I think the insider establishments can live with Ben Sasse in Nebraska. I mean, Ben Sasse is a university president who worked in the Bush administration. The notion that he's this Tea Party grassroots guy, I think, is really the product of him running a smart campaign and knowing how to win a Republican primary. And the other thing that muddies this up is, even though Ben Sasse was the conservative candidate who was endorsed by essentially the entire, basically the entire conservative movement was unanimously behind Ben Sasse, with a couple of exceptions. But by and large, even FreedomWorks had flipped and endorsed Ben Sasse. So he, you know, but even though he was the Tea Party guy, right before Election Day, Shane Osborne decides to sign this pledge by this group called FAIR, which is a group that opposes not only illegal immigration, but increases in legal immigration and visas and whatnot. So at the very end, Shane Osborne tries to outflank Sasse by, I would argue, demagoguing the immigration issue. So it really muddies the waters in terms of, like, who's the grassroots conservative populist Tea Party guy. And it's, you know, last week I told you that Renee Elmers, maybe it was 2 weeks ago, that Renee Elmers winning in North Carolina, you know, wasn't a huge deal. It doesn't imply that, you know, because she's pro-immigration reform, it doesn't imply much. Well, now you're starting to build a narrative, right? Because you got this guy, Shane Osborne, who, in an act of desperation, I think, at the very last minute, decided to try to make immigration an issue in Nebraska by sort of out-populisting Ben Sasse. And it did not work. He ended up coming in third place, and I think a kind of a shameful finish. Meanwhile, you have Ben Sasse. The day of the election goes on Chuck Todd's Daily Rundown show and sort of extends an olive branch to Mitch McConnell and the Republican establishment. Then he puts out a memo, or his strategist put out a memo last night reinforcing what I had written, what I had predicted, what I had sort of known, saying that, you know, he's not going to be a reflexive no vote, and nor is he going to go out of his way to attack the establishment. He's going to be a serious conservative, and there may be times when he opposes the establishment, but he's not going to be a bomb thrower. And so I think at the end of the day, it's funny, but I think Tillis and Sasse are probably not all that different. There's not a lot of daylight between them. And I think you're probably getting sophisticated, smart, electable conservatives now coming out of these races, regardless of which side, you know, the chamber versus the Tea Party, you know, you're not seeing a lot of daylight between these candidates now. And if you're a conservative, it's an optimistic thing.
So, I mean, there may not be a lot of daylight between Sasse and Tillis. Do you think there's that much daylight between Sasse and Osborne? I mean, were there any, you mentioned immigration, was there actual daylight between the two in immigration? Was there actual daylight on any other substantive issue? Can you explain why some of the Tea Party groups made this kind of a litmus test, why FreedomWorks disendorsed Osborne and went to Sasse? What's the behind-the-scenes logic here?
Well, how much time you got? I could talk about this all day. And there was a third candidate named Sid Dinsdale, who's a banker. I think he would have been the third richest person in the U.S. Senate, who was a self-funder who came in second. So this race is very interesting. So to sort of answer your question, Shane Osborne was thought of as a military hero. He was a pilot. And he was also the treasurer of the state treasurer in Nebraska. And he was originally endorsed by FreedomWorks. Ben Sasse was, to be honest with you, I think that the Tea Party and some of these outside conservative groups have a bias toward somebody who's new and fresh. And Ben Sasse is just better looking, younger looking, and incredibly smart and a very good talker. And he jumped on the Obamacare issue immediately since. I think the guy's a very shrewd strategist himself. I think he basically ran his own campaign. And I think he sensed that that there was an opening and that Obamacare, that he could sort of make that his issue. And I think he was absolutely right about that. I think the Tea Party was kind of hungry for somebody new and fresh and young and charismatic, which isn't exactly the most substantive reason to back somebody. But I think that's what they do. I mean, this fits into the whole Republicans' identity politics thing. I mean, I think Sasse was just a very appealing candidate, you know. So I don't necessarily think it was fair. No pun intended. I don't necessarily think it was fair that all the conservatives backed Sasse. And for a long time, I felt a little bit sorry for Osborne because, you know, FreedomWorks essentially, having endorsed him, threw Osborne under the bus, rescinded their endorsement of him, based almost solely on the fact that all the other cool kids, the other conservative groups, were behind Sasse, and because Osborne was liked by the establishment, by Mitch McConnell. Like, that was his sin. Not that he had done anything wrong, but just because that. Now, there's also this other interesting underbelly, which is a sort of a populist conservative thing, where anti-immigration people like Laura Ingraham and Phyllis Schlafly and Kris Kobach, who is a Kansas conservative who I think authored the Arizona bill, the controversial Arizona bill, where they do not trust Sasse. I mean, Ben Sasse doesn't have a voting record. It's hard to like say what a great conservative he doesn't have a voting record. And so they, at some point, you know, Ben Sasse refused to sign this pledge by this group, this fair pledge, because he basically said, look, I'm against amnesty. I think we need to secure the border. But if we do that, if we secure the border, I wouldn't be opposed 10 years from now and having some sort of a pathway to citizenship. I'm not going to sign a pledge saying that that I'll never consider that. Well, Shane Osborne, I think, out of desperation, having been abandoned by the rest of the conservative movement, saw this kind of populist group. You know, Mickey Kouse will be mad at me for daring to say nativist, but you know, we can argue about that. But whatever that, you know, however you want to describe these folks, you know what? He would prefer it if I say, what was the word?
Restrictionist.
That's the word. I will use that word. So, somehow Shane Osborne hopped on this restrictionist bandwagon, and it got him nowhere because he went down in flames. No pun intended, once again. Now, there's an interesting other discussion here, which is about military people. And that I do hear grumblings amongst conservatives that, you know, conservatives are supposed to love military, right? But amongst some fiscal conservatives, there is a sense that military people, and for some reason this doesn't apply to Tom Cotton, but that they are too used to taking orders and that they, therefore, may be susceptible to being led by the leadership, by the establishment. I don't know if that factored into why you would endorse Sasse, a guy who doesn't have a voting record, over Osborne, but I think it may have in some quarters, and it's a weird, interesting theory, isn't it?
It is, but I am struck by that immigration back and forth, also coming off of the Renee Elmer's race, where she was outright for immigration reform and won her primary pretty handily. Also, today, you have a op-ed in Roll Call, the congressional newspaper, by one of the founders of the Tea Party Express, one of the myriad of Tea Party groups that are out there, a guy by the name of Sal Russo, and he comes out in favor of immigration reform. He stops short of a path to citizenship, but he supports a legalization for the currently undocumented with various, you know, fines, learn English, yada, yada, yada. So you have another point of division within the conservative base on this subject. We're going to end this this period of congressional primaries in a few weeks. They're not all done, but they're mostly done after mid to late June. You have a congressional work period, you know, from Memorial Day to the end of July. Then you have August recess. Then you have, you know, the general election campaign in the fall. President Obama meets with law enforcement agencies yesterday and says, "We got 2 to 3 months here. This is our window. Make this happen." I think the subtle message being, if Republicans don't step up, then I'm going to do executive actions to alleviate some of the deportations. Do you have an aligning of stars here with Republicans not suffering anti-immigration backlash in the primaries? You have some newfound Tea Party support. You have Boehner making some noise that he's still open to getting something done this year. Could this actually happen?
I don't think so, Bill. So, first, let's talk about Sal Russo, because it's interesting. My former colleague, Alexis Levinson, who's now at roll call. By the way, let me just say, people don't realize the Daily Caller is you know, a breeding ground for terrific journalists like Chris Moody at Yahoo, like Alexis Levinson at Roll Call, like John Ward at the Huffington Post, and others. Kudos to her. She wrote a piece a few months ago for the Daily Caller, pointing out how, like, a lot, and by the way, the Washington Post essentially recycled that piece like 3 months later, about how these Tea Party groups basically just pay themselves and consultants a lot of money and don't actually spend a lot of money on candidates. But Sal Russo, it's interesting because this is a guy who's a Republican political consultant who's been around for decades, who runs or co-runs one of the most prominent Tea Party groups. And this, again, this is a Republican political operative who's been around for many, many years, who, like, is now a Tea Party guy. So, I don't know. I find that interesting.
I mean, does this Tea Party Express do actual Tea Party things? Do they have chapters? Do they endorse candidates? What do they do?
I think they're one of the more prominent, important groups. I mean, I think that they were they do, like, bus tours, and I think they were very important in 2010 with people like Sharon Angle and others that they would endorse, and it was a pretty big deal. So I think that they have the name Tea Party. I think that a lot of what they do is actually raise money and then, you know, endorse candidates and ostensibly, occasionally, sometimes run ads or help them. But they, you know, they're as legit as any Tea Party group can be legit. So, you know, it's not like this is like the Liberty Fund or, you know, I mean, this is one of the most prominent Tea Party groups. Which interestingly is run by a Republican, you know, political consultant who's been around for a long, 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 long time. But going to your, like, sort of larger, more important question about immigration reform, I mean, you know, despite the fact that we're seeing things in Nebraska and North Carolina, and I mean, there is still the people who are against immigration reform are utterly passionate about. The people who are for it, you know, there's the line, the worst are full of passionate intensity while the best are, you know, I'm trying to think of the poem. Someone in the comments, I'm sure, will remind me what it is.
I forget the specific quote, but I know what you're saying.
But the people who are against immigration reform, I'll put it to you a different way. A friend of mine once said, when you run for political office, your friends will work all day to get you elected, but your enemies will work all night to make sure you don't. And there is an intensity gap. And the people who are against this on the right are really against it. And they are passionate about it. The only way this happens, the only way it happens is if John Boehner somehow pulls a parliamentary trick, you know, somehow passing some bill that's like nominally about immigration and using that as a pretext to establish, some sort of a conference committee and then put it on the floor and rely on Democrats voting for it and only a few Republicans. I mean, the only way this happens this year, Bill, is if some sort of trickery by Boehner, it would go nuclear if that were to happen.
Well, it was only a few weeks ago where Boehner literally put a bill on the floor without telling his caucus he was doing it, announcing a voice vote when no one was around, and letting it go through that way. So he's not beyond parliamentary trickery when he feels like he needs to do it to avoid a larger political problem. I mean, this was involving the Medicare, the so-called doc fix.
This is different. This is different.
Well, I agree this is different, that I don't think that's kind of an inside-the-weeds issue. I think he was sort of diffusing a problem before it metastasized. If he couldn't get conservatives to vote for it outright, then and all the Medicare, all the doctors' fees, skyrocket, then he's got a larger political problem. This he could do a little bit more quietly. I agree he can't do that kind of shell game with immigration without it being a much bigger deal. My point is just that it shows you what he's capable of doing. He has the will, and he has the moral and procedural flexibility to do things like that when he feels it is in the larger Republican political interest.
Okay, but what I'm saying is, while it is physically within the realm of possibility that this happens, it would have to be by virtue of parliamentary trickery, because what doesn't happen is persuasion. You are not going to convince enough House Republicans to vote for this via argument and debate and discussion in order for it to pass in a normal sort of way. By the way, I've got the quote here. I have the quote. It's Yates, and it's, "The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity." Mm-hmm. That is the quote, and it only took me 5 minutes to find it. That's what's great about writing. You don't have the brain farts with writing. Nobody sees that you don't remember that you have to, like, Google something. That's what writing is so much better than talking.
Speaking of talking, in my neighborhood here in Northampton, Massachusetts, I live a mere three blocks from the esteemed campus of Smith College, I don't know who exactly to point the finger at, but a colossal embarrassment has occurred, where the president of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, was invited to be the commencement speaker in a few days. Your average, petition gets circulated saying, she should be disinvited. The IMF is oppressive, and it's a tool of international austerity and destroying third world nations, blah, blah, blah. And for some reason, I can't quite tell you, someone flinched. I don't know if it was the Smith College establishment or was it Christine Lagarde herself. Technically speaking, Lagarde declined. There's her call there. I think there's some speculation that she did under pressure, but no one can say for sure. I know today that some of the economic department of Smith expressed their disappointment in the decision that they want her to come. So I think we should be careful not to say it's all of the Smith campus body or all of the Smith faculty. But certainly, it's certainly at least a temporary embarrassment to Smith, and it's feeding this whole notion that this wave of political correctness is resurfacing on college campuses. There have been other examples where speakers have been pressured to bow out. And I think this, in this particular case, I mean, there's always certain examples. You know, for I know, for example, Ben Carson was forced out in Johns Hopkins because they felt he said bigoted things towards gays. I think bigotry is a different standard, quite frankly. I am less put off when someone is saying something outright bigoted towards blacks or towards gays. I think that is that is like properly stigmatized. In my opinion, this is a difference of opinion of global economic development. You know, people have different opinions about things, and even beyond just the basic difference of opinion, the knock on the IMF going back decades does not fall on the shoulders of the person who's been president for the last 3 years. She's not responsible for the entire history of the IMF, and there's plenty of arguing that she has been reforming the IMF and making it fairer to poorer nations. So the critique in of itself is off the mark. There's just no way you can have speakers come to campuses who check off every ideological box. It's impossible. People have differences of opinion. It's a ridiculous standard.
I think that by and large, you should welcome diversity and diversity of opinion, diversity of ideology. Unless it's really egregious, I would say bring people in I disagree with. I mean, if there are, you know, there are some people who I think should not be welcomed on. I would not want welcomed on my campus, but that list is very small. There are a lot of people who hold positions that I disagree with, you know, to a great degree that I would think should be, you know, part of college and education is exposing yourself to diverse opinions. And I do think this is emblematic of something that conservatives have long noted, which is that liberals posture themselves as being about diversity, as being about, you know, free speech and diversity of opinion, and yet they're the ones who essentially want to like discriminate against and censor political speech. You know, Condi Rice essentially drummed out of speaking recently as well. And I just think it's a shame that these things, you know, that it happens. There's a huge difference in the amount of liberal speakers who are invited to speak on campuses and who end up speaking on campuses versus conservatives. I mean, there's a huge disparity. And so even though I suspect you could find examples of liberals, you know, we can cite examples of liberals not being invited to speak or permitted to speak on campus. I mean, there are a lot more liberals who end up doing it than conservatives. So, I mean, I think it's just shameful.
I mean, I assume there's not a lot of liberals being invited to speak at Bob Jones. You know, there's probably some. You don't even have these controversies at Bob Jones. They don't even get invited to it in the first place. So I think there's certainly conservative academic environments where richness of intellectual diversity is not present. I know Karl Rove has spoken in some of the schools in this area. John Ashcroft spoke here recently. Plenty of people do actually come, and people come and protest, but they do actually come and they actually have the speech. Often these people are invited by, you know, a local college Republicans chapter, and they really have no reason to disinvite them. They were brought by a campus group. The college administration doesn't have a say over it necessarily, and people have an argument, and that's fine.
I was telling you about that book, The Last Empire, about the fall of the Soviet Union. And, I mean, this has been going on for a long time. There's a part in the book where George H.W. Bush, he had been booed or something speaking at a commencement speech. So they wouldn't let – I'm trying to think of exactly how it was. The faculty wouldn't let Barbara Bush speak unless – but she brought Raisa Gorbachev with her, and they both did the commencement speech, and therefore it was acceptable. So a communist is, you know, as long as you bring a communist along, then a Republican's safe to speak at this college campus.
Well, I mean, a commencement speech, the thing that's sort of strange about this is commencement speeches generally are not political. They're not there to make a political argument. Right. They're there to celebrate the graduates. So I feel like this is, I don't really think it's much of a free speech issue. We know no one is saying that the free speech is about the law. I mean, no one's saying you're not allowed to speak.
No, I know, but I'm talking about people who rhetorically advocate, you know, hey man, just as long as you don't hurt anybody, and like, I'm all for diversity of opinion, you know. Like, I don't want to, like, censor anybody. You know, turn off the TV if you don't like what's on. Like, that's the mentality, and yet they're the first people to shut down somebody that they disagree with coming to campus.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know the individual people making the criticism, so I don't think it's fair to say that they are displaying an internal hypocrisy, because I don't know what their views are about intellectual diversity or their views about, you know, lyrics on music or what have you. They may well have a coherent philosophy here that's being expressed. Because, look, you could say, look, this is my campus. I'm a faculty member. It's a faculty-run governance structure. We choose what rises to the level of good intellectual discourse. And, you know, there are certain people who think don't contribute positive to that discourse, and we think they shouldn't come here. I mean, everyone makes decisions on who comes and who doesn't. So I don't necessarily think it's. I don't think it's. I don't see it as an hypocrisy issue. I see it as a stupidity issue. There's no good reason in this case to say this person would not is the most probably the most powerful woman in the world. Okay. But an accomplished problem in the world should not have something to say at one of the few women's only educational institutions in the country. You know, she has something to say about women's education and what women graduates can do to contribute to the world, whether or not you agree with her on global economic development. You know, she's a plausible person to serve in that role. So I just think it's very short-sighted. I don't think it means that people are hypocritical necessarily. I just think they're being very misguided. I don't see this as a First Amendment issue, but I just think it's just soft-headed, particularly at a college where, I mean, college is supposed to be about expanding your mind, to take someone who, you know, is not a crackpot, is not a low-rent, you know, figure, and say she doesn't have something to contribute to the conversation. That's strange to me.
Yes, I agree. We agree on that. And when we do our college tour, Bill, get used to this. This is going to be, you know, we'll probably be picketed and protested. And I fully expect somebody to throw a pie in my face.
If you want to protest, look, I mean, if you want to boycott, if you want to try to pressure her not to speak, I think you have a First Amendment right to do that. I can't fault someone for having their own opinion about the IMF and expressing it in their way. That's their choice. I think it was weak either on the part of Lagarde or Smith College, I don't know who exactly, to fold in the face of that. It didn't strike me as necessary. I mean, there's some argument that I hear, I don't know, again, not in the specific case, but I hear in general, some of these college administrations flinch because they want the parents and the potential donors to have a good commencement experience. And if it's marred by any kind of friction, it undercuts that potentially. So that is why they have an itchy trigger finger about this stuff sometimes.
But that just rewards, the squeaky oil gets the grease. I mean, that just rewards the whatever side is the, you know, whatever side's the most annoying will end up winning by virtue, you know, because they'll be rewarded for being annoying. And we know which side that is, Bill. We know which side. On campus.
I think it's a bigger spectacle. It's even a bigger spectacle to flinch at the last minute when it's someone of as high esteem as Lagarde. I think that's the bigger black guy. Again, I'm not a development director. I don't know what the donors want, so I'm just speaking from my bar stool here. But that strikes me as not the best strategy. I think people in college administration should realize, look, I went to a very liberal college. Every commencement was full of last-minute protests. It's usually the last FU to the college establishment. That's what commencement is. It's never going to be this perfect, you know, Kodak moment all the time. People are going to get their last licks in. That's just the deal. So I think people should be a little thicker-skinned about that and not panic in these situations.
Yeah, I think we should be a little cooler about it. And, you know, diversity of opinion. It's welcome people we disagree with. don't have to agree with them. You have to protest them. But there should be a mix. Should be a mix. So.
I expect Bob Jones at any minute now to invite Ralph Nader to speak.
Stranger things have happened. Stranger things have happened.
We're always going to talk to you, Matt, where free speech is treasured.
That's right.
and we'll talk next week. Take care.